Welcome to Foodcast. I'm your host, Rick, and today we have Phil and Gavin for the Rice at the Cove. Welcome to Foodcast.
Thanks for having us.
Tell us, how came the idea of the Rice at the Cove?
Well, everyone actually calls it the Rise now. So even though it's Rise of the Cove, it's become known colloquially around Greystones as the Rise. So that's kind of, you'll hear people in the streets just saying, I'll meet you at the Rise, or I'll meet you at Rise. Even just one word, just Rise.
Yeah.
And everyone knows where they're talking about. But I suppose I left Phil take that one because it was his idea. And he kind of got me involved at the early stages when we started to develop the actual cafe.
Yeah.
The initial idea was all Phil. So I let him talk about that.
I suppose the backstory of it is, you know, behind the cafe is an organization called Tiglin, and one of the founders of Tiglin. You know, the idea of the cafe was to bridge the gap between who we normally work with, which is traditionally men and women who have found themselves on the wrong side of addiction and homelessness and things like that, and the community of Greystones, where we provide a lot of different supports to people who we work with. And for many years, we've seen that there's a bit of a gap between the ones we help and the place that we live. And so the ideal way to bridge that gap was to open up a social enterprise cafe. And that created a brilliant space for people from different walks of life to interact in a very normal way. And it also became a great way to bring financial support and fundraising to Tiglin.
Wow, that's great to hear. And why came that passion to help the people around, like at first place?
Yeah. I suppose my background before the cafe and before even starting Tiglin, so myself and a friend, Aubrey McCarty, who's the chairman of Tiglin, we started Tiglin in 2008.
Yeah.
And before that, I worked in the homeless services in Dublin, and it was just through the interactions of meeting people on the streets, understanding the challenges that presents for many people who want to find a way to live a life away from addiction, and how difficult that can be when you're surrounded by chaos and you're separated from society, that it can be very challenging to even, first of all, get to the doors of a rehab, let alone stay in that rehab. And if you're lucky enough to find the ability to complete that program, well, then you find yourself at the end of a program again, usually with nowhere to go. So it was the idea and the vision was to set up a long-term rehab that had lots of different structures and supports and elements to it, with a housing model at the end. That meant that those who did that kind of long, brave journey had a support at the end to make sure that they didn't have to return to homelessness again.
Wow. And why Greystones? You said you're starting Dublin and setting up there. And why you choose Greystones to be the, let's say, your headquarter, your base?
It wasn't by design. I suppose we, in 2007, we came across the old Tiglin Mountaineering Centre in Ashford. That became our men's program.
Yeah.
The first couple of guys that finished that program, we found ourselves kind of wondering, well, how do we help these guys? They have nowhere to go. They finished the program. They're clean. They're sober. They have their families back in their lives, but still they're not ready to return to family environments or family home for whatever reason. And so we heard about this building called Carrigeden in Greystones that was a former theological college but had closed, and it was lying empty. So we asked, could we rent one room or two rooms or three rooms? And that quickly became, within about 2 or 3 years, the entire building.
Wow.
With men who had completed the program. And for years, from 2009 and that slow build, for years that building sat there with a variety of guys who come through our program. But the community of Greystones, in a way, were separated from that. Even though it's in the heart of the community, there was no interactions, because I suppose we didn't really want to advertise the fact that this was a version or a reintroduction to life after rehab. Because some people can be intimidated by that.
Mm-hmm.
It also can be a bit of a case that some people want to live their own lives in an anonymous way. And yes, I suppose over the course of time, people got very positively attracted to what we did because they seen the evidence of changed lives. So the idea of the cafe came up because we had interactions with local Wicklow County Council, and the building that Rise of the Cove is in came out of a discussion with Wicklow County Council around, wouldn't it be great if we were able to operate a cafe? And it was this kind of joined up thinking that brought it to be. So the idea was, at the start, was kind of training, development opportunities. And myself and Gavin crossed paths and it became something a lot more than that, you know.
And the red tape was difficult to go through, or like you went under the radar with, like, not just with the cafe, but like when you establish the house there, as you said, lots of people, sometimes they feel shame for what happened, or the community, as you said, now they're very supportive.
Yeah.
How was that process to actually open the cafe? Was something natural or was something more difficult for you?
I think
in the business side, sorry.
The cafe didn't have a lot of barriers in that sense, because by that time, the community had, a few years previous to the cafe, had supported us in an initiative to make sure that that building was not sold to a developer. Yeah. So they had already invested their interests in making sure that, that building remained as a place that people could call home who ordinarily wouldn't have anywhere else to go. So I think they had developed that attraction, even if that was only on a small scale, because still a lot of people didn't have a clue what went on in that building. But those who did were community people and they had an interest. So the opening of the cafe wasn't a big struggle, in the sense that we knew that it would be accepted. But at the same time, it wasn't necessarily setting out down this road of having, you know, Greystone's version of Starbucks. It was just a case that we wanted to have a place that, you know, those on both sides of the counter could interact and, you know, community could develop around a simple cup of coffee.
Yeah, it's challenging what you're saying, because you're in a prime location there. Mm. That's a beautiful place. Like the view you have, if you're like now summertime, literally you sit there in the balcony, you have the sea view.
Yeah.
It's beautiful. Even the winter day is beautiful. Oh, yeah. It's beautiful anyway there.
Was it not raining?
And when I went there, it was raining.
Yeah, but
it still was nice. It's beautiful. And like seeing now with that attention, all the like all thoughts going to you, how's actually the people being rehabilitated and going there, how they feel at the moment? Because it's different. Like before they go there and say, okay, nobody knows I'm here, I'm going slowly back to society, getting feeling comfortable. Because the main thing is not the physical, I would say, is the mental. Is something very difficult for them to see that and going straight in the spotlight.
I think, I personally think when we opened the cafe, the guys who lived in the house, so apart from the guys who actually worked there, so to say four guys worked there, but like there were still 25 guys in the house, they didn't really come in at the start and have coffees and teas, because I think, you know, all the sea swimmers with their dry robes and the cars, they were all there, and they kind of, I think there was initially a bit of, well, we shouldn't go down and chat to them. But then the first few kind of came down and they got chatting to the customers. And now, I mean, the guys are in every day. Like all the guys who live in the house and they interact with all, like they go swimming together, and they, you know, some of the guys are little designers. They make sea glass and jewelry, and they sit and show all the guys the stuff they make. And it's just become this. And like they know everyone by first name, and just hugs and kisses in the morning from the guys who live in the house and all the regulars who previous to this would never have known each other existed, you know? And it's, I suppose the idea was to break barriers, but I mean, it smashed them. You know, I mean, it's like I could drive up Greystones Main Street and I see two of our guys standing with two 80-year-old ladies from Greystones, and they're standing having a chat on the side of the road. And it's just, it's a great thing to see. And I think it was the fear, wasn't it, initially? Like people fear what they don't know.
Yes.
So they knew the house was there and they could see the guys sitting outside, and they'd always have a little look in, and there was almost like a shush shush thing. But as soon as they realized, everyone that has addiction, they're only people. Like everyone's a person. And when you kind of take away that whole label of they're a recovering addict or they're this or they're that, and when they get to know it's Sean or it's John or it's Mike, and they realize these are really good blokes, you know, they're such good guys that just had a really bad time, you know, and it could happen to anyone. Like I've met people since I started there, from the day I started to now, like probably 50, 60 guys who've come through, and not one is the same. You know, there's guys from Cork, there's guys from Dublin, there's 18-year-olds, there's 60-year-olds, and they all have different stories, but it's all the same.
And you
know?
Guys see benefits, like Phil, you're in the business, let's say business, for many years looking after people. do you see is a fast track what the RISE is doing at the moment with those people?
Yeah, I suppose by the time somebody comes to live in the building first, yeah, called Carrageen, they've done 9 months in rehab, which is, you know, by all standards, is an extremely long time for rehabilitation. So,
yeah,
you know, we do operate the longest rehab in the country. So, you know, in that sense, you know, a lot of programs could be 12 weeks long. This is 9 months.
Wow.
So it's quite intensive. It's very rounded. There's a lot. It's biopsychosocial, spiritual. There's a lot of stuff that goes on there. So by the time they come down, they've had lots of opportunities to go out, be with family, meet people, engage again with their own, say, children or whatever it might be, to go and establish a social life. All of those things have slowly started to return to their life again. So then when they arrive down to Carrageen, they're not met with an opportunity that says, here, you can work in the cafe. Nobody's forced to do anything. They don't have to go near the cafe if they don't want to.
Yeah.
They also then during the day are offered 7 more months of aftercare, Monday to Friday aftercare.
Yeah.
And it's not until that aftercare component is complete
that they can actually,
work in it.
So it's 16 months from the day they go to Tickle Inn to the time they can work in the cafe.
Wow.
So that's a, like, when you think of it, yeah, it's a huge amount of time.
Wow.
But you asked about, like, you know, that kind of breaking of the stigma or the barrier that, you know, was that, there was a lot of different things that had to be broken in that. For a long time, the building was associated almost with a sense of mystery because I said it was a theological college before we started using. Before that, it seemed to be some kind of a guest house within a church structure or something like that. So,
because there was tennis courts and champagne rooms and everything in, like, 70 years ago in that, on that site.
Yeah, so you had this kind of sense that for a long time, the community didn't really own it or belong in it. It sat up there on the hill and people knew that it was vaguely associated with some kind of a church body or something like that, but they didn't feel it was theirs as such.
Yeah.
So that was as much of a stigma to break as it was around almost the stigma around addiction or homelessness. So what was interesting was that to break that, you know, a simple cup of coffee, a friendly space, and a place where the community came in was a really interesting way to do it. And it has done that excessively.
And what are the benefits to have such a people? Like, because if, as you said, like 16 months, correct?
Mm.
The program is a lot of time to commit. And to get through that, you need to have a very strong mindset. And when you get these kind of people to come to, as you said, sometimes work or not, but if they get to work, what's the benefits you have as a, let's say, as a business in the cafe?
Because in our industry, as you know, most of the issues with KPs and staff is they're coming in hungover on the weekend. So that's instantly, that's never an issue. So, I mean, the guys live beside us, so they can, they're never late. Like, I can see their bedrooms, so they're in work. But that's all jokes aside. I mean, these guys generally have at that point made their mind up that they want to be clean and sober. And then most of them have kind of thought to themselves, well, I want an apartment or I want a job. But there's, it's very difficult to go from living in a one bed rented place to then going and renting your own, especially now in a housing crisis.
Jesus Christ,
so
yes.
What you do is you need references. You need work references. You need, you know, housing references. So the cafe has given them a chance to build up a really good CV.
Yeah.
You know, so like one of my guys, not only has he done the 16-month program, he's now done 18, 19 months in the cafe and he's now my manager.
Wow.
So, I mean, he has a huge background now in the industry that I would probably happily send him to any cafe or restaurant in Ireland and not think he would let himself down. And I mean, like, I would send him to any cafe or any coffee shop in Ireland. And he would easily just fit into any system.
And actually, like, the way you guys make the coffee there is amazing.
Yeah.
Let's start with that well brew.
But, like, when Phil brought me in, I sat down, but I think it was the initial meeting was with 18, 20 guys in the day program.
Yeah.
And we sat down and I was very open and honest. And I said, this is not it's not a charity case. So I'm not going to bring you in and go, oh, you can do what you want and you can come in late. I said, if we're opening this coffee shop, I said, I only know one way to run coffee shops. And I said, it's going to be good. So we're going to use the best coffee, the best produce, and you guys are going to be the best staff. And I said, not only are we going to make nice coffee, I said, I think we can make the best coffee in Greystones. And I said, if we get the backing from the guys to get the nice machine and get everything in place, I said, I will train you guys to the same level I trained anyone in the last 20 years, if you're willing to do it.
Yeah.
And I think initially it was 15 guys interested. When they heard that, only four or five were, you know, because it wasn't going to be a come in when you want and kind of, you know, make. I was like, this is going to be a high standard. So yeah. And one of my guys, you know, it took him a long time to realize I wasn't having a go at him. I was having a go at him as a barista, not him as a person, because it's difficult. Because when I'm telling him he's doing things wrong, he's like, "What's?" And I said, "You're not the problem." I said, "Your standard of work isn't." And now all of a sudden, he's calling other people up for mistakes I used to call him up on, and everyone's level is this, you know. And we all rose together. So all of us now, if someone comes in and they're not good enough, everyone that works on the line is kind of like, you know, I don't need to tell them. Their own workmates are going, "Yeah, man, you need to do it better, because you're making us all look bad." And that's, you know, that's a, you know, you're in a good team when you've yes. got the last person in the door calling out the new person in, kind of going, this is where we need to be, you know, because we could be doing 700-800 coffees in a day. So like we need to be really on the ball, you know, we need to be turning things fast. But we all love it, you know, there's a great buzz. Like when we started, we were doing 50 coffees a day, and that was great. That was, you know, everyone was kind of thinking this is amazing. And I'm like, you don't believe how busy we're going to get. Because I knew, like, when Phil showed me the location the first day, I'm like, you're going to put a coffee shop here. I was like, I couldn't handpick a better place in Wicklow to put a coffee shop. Because it's just, like, there's 20 coffee shops in Greystones. We're the only one that can see the sea.
Yeah.
You know, it's crazy that they built the entire town away from the seaside. Because in Bray, everything's on the seafront, you know? Whereas Greystones, it was almost like, let's not let them see the sea. So we got that opportunity. But I'm like, location is nothing if you don't give them the right
product, amazing, you know? Like you said about like products and they in the quality of the products you have there. I know it's like, oh, of course we can't grow coffee in Ireland.
No.
But well,
we can roast it.
Oh yeah. You guys roast in house or you have a different.
No. At the moment we don't roast in house. My brother actually was a coffee roaster for a long time, and we had looked at different coffee roasters, but he gave us a sample. Yeah. He just gave us some samples to work with when we were training, because initially Phil had consulted my brother as well, who's in the industry, to come on board, and he'd just taken a job and he said, you know, I think Gavin's free at the moment. So we kind of worked together at the start, and Shane said, look, here's some lovely Guatemalan coffee we have. Use that to train all the boys in. And he came down and trained with us. And the first day we made coffee, Aubrey was there, who's our chairman. Phil was there, a few of the guys from the house, and I started making them flat whites, and I was giving them out, and they were all like, "This is one of the best coffees I've ever tasted." And I was like, because I'd never tasted it, and I said to my brother, "This is unbelievable." And he's like, "Well, you can have it." He said, "That wasn't the one I was going to give you. This was just, it was old stock he had. It was almost like gone past its sell by date. He was just letting us train with it."
Yeah.
And I said, "Can we get this?" And he's like, "If you want." And I'm like, this will put us on the map if we can use this coffee.
Yeah.
Now it was more expensive, obviously. But you know, yeah, our kind of model is we don't mind paying a little bit more for the base product if we know it's exceptional, if we know it's local, because people will then pay a bit more for that. But also, the better the product, people will come back. People don't mind paying 3-4 euro if it's really good. Yeah. It's if you're giving them rubbish and they're kind of going, look, I'll go elsewhere. Because if it's the difference between 3 and 3.50, it doesn't, like, for me, it doesn't make a difference.
Yeah.
And certainly in Greystones, people don't care if it's a couple of cent more or less. What they want is...
it's quality.
For 3.50, am I going to get a good coffee? Because they can go around the corner.
Also, the essence of that whole notion of quality was, yes, people don't want to pay good money for something that's substandard or okay. But also, the idea was, behind the counter for many, many years, the guys and the girls who are overcoming huge challenges in their life have often understood or struggled with the idea that they're less than. And so if they're serving something that's of a less quality or a cheaper grade,
they won't appreciate.
They feel that actually that's a, in a way, that's a representation of me. Whereas if you serve the best coffee, you serve high quality produce, and you serve it in a great location that people appreciate, there's a kind of a message that's dripped down almost by osmosis to the guys and the girls behind the counter that I matter, I'm valued. This is really good. Go work with a crummy, cheap coffee somewhere else. People are just grabbing it and they're gone. There's no atmosphere. There's no appreciation. I feel cheap.
Yeah, there's no passion.
That's what we wanted to make sure. This isn't just about quality for the sense of quality. It's also about what's the message behind that.
I used to work for Ritz-Carlton.
Yeah.
And there's one of their mottos, and like literally every single day is like, you need to repeat, we are ladies and gentlemen serving ladies and gentlemen.
Yeah. Yeah.
So that's bring you, as a young chef, you look and say, oh, I'm a gentleman.
Yeah.
You know, like 20 years old and you feel taller.
Yeah.
Just because of that.
But just because you're serving somebody doesn't mean you're less than them. It doesn't mean you're worse than, you know. But now people come in and they look up to our guys, you know, and like...
Mm-hmm.
Sean, my manager, you know, he was in the Irish Times recently and the article went viral and it's been on the wall 6 weeks now, maybe 6 or 7 weeks. And even today, someone came into him and they were like, are you the guy that was in the Irish Times? They were like, it blew me away, like your story and stuff. And you could just see, like, you know, you could see him. He was just, and sometimes 7 people a day will say it to him and you can kind of, he's like, yeah, I am the guy, you know. But it's just so nice for him to get that recognition, and they're not coming in and just saying, give me a coffee and turn the back. They're like, are you, you know, and tell me a little bit about yourself. And I think the initial thing before any of this sort of blew up, the thing that showed me it was going to work was a lady from the community came in, and I would have known her, you know, and she was fairly well off and stuff. And because I think people associate addiction with only poor people, which is such a wrong idea.
Yeah.
So this lady came in and she came up to the counter and she got upset quite quickly. And she's like, can I talk to someone? And I was like, yeah. And she said, look, my brother or brother-in-law, I can't remember. She goes, he's really struggling. What do I do? And another guy who was working with me who'd come through the program. And I just said, come here, just bring her to the end of the counter. And we were busy, but I was like, they went over to the corner and they were gone for 20 minutes. And next minute she was gone, a little hug, and he'd given her a number. And she came back in a few weeks later and she's like, my brother got in. And she's like, you know, I can't. And I was like, there you go. In that instant, if that's the only person we helped by opening the coffee shop. And I was like, then I realized it was more than a coffee. You know, I think it was until that moment I didn't realize maybe the power of what we were doing. And that's happened at least 8 or 10 times since, that people have come up and said, by the way, you know, I'm in recovery. And these are people you're like, are well-known people for us that are businessmen and they tell you stuff they never told anyone else because they feel that's a little safe space for them. And I just think it was that's made it kind of nice for
me. Can you guys feel the weight in your shoulders about, you know, like what you're doing now? You know, like the responsibility actually become to get those people out there, to put them in the spotlight in a good way. And now, like, what the expectation of the people of your products, everything, is that make you feel pressure? In a sense, sorry.
I suppose it's only when some people say it, and like my wife says to me sometimes, do you realize what a great thing you're doing? Like, you went, Phil, and some, like, because for me, I just come in and I'm running a coffee shop. So it's only when someone says certain things, because honestly, I forget that we, at this point, I think very quickly after a few weeks, I forgot that I worked with people in addiction because they just became really close friends.
Yeah.
Like, some of them were up at my nephew's birthday party the other day in the house. So like, these guys just up and hugging the kids and stuff. So they just became part of my life. So I kind of forgot almost about that part of it.
Mm-hmm.
But then with the article, say, but Sean was in the paper, and it just went viral, like thousands of shares.
Yeah.
And then when people come in and you realize this never would have happened without the coffee shop or without Tiglin. You know, and these guys have got this. But not only what it did for them, what it did for people who read it, who may be in a similar position, who were kind of, they don't even know where to look to, where to turn to. And they're like, but this is a place that might help me, you know? And I think it's really shone a massive spotlight on Tiglin as an organization. Like, the coffee shop being in the media and kind of having people in has actually shown people that you shouldn't be ashamed to ask for help.
See, I think though, like, behind your question is, like, do we feel a burden or responsibility? I suppose the answer to that is both yes and no, in the sense that if you're employed to do any job, responsibility comes and a burden comes in one way or another. Nothing in life is a walk in the park. But when you've got people who are good at what they do, you know, so in the cafe as the example, you know, Gavin was brought in because he's good at what he does. He works with people, he trains people, he knows how to connect with the people in the community and all of those things. Same with the other aspects of Tiglin. There's rehabs, there's housing programs, there's homeless outreach services, there's lots of different things. But when you have people in the right place who are trained to do those jobs, who are passionate about the jobs, passionate about the people, you know that those services will run well and reach people and serve people really, really well. yes, there's a burden. Yes, there's a responsibility. But the outcomes are in those conversations that Gavin alluded to there, where, you know, you get a member of the public coming in, sharing their burden with somebody who's overcome huge challenges around addiction. And the very thing that was meant to destroy their life, to almost take their life, is then used to inspire this lady to bring back a message of hope to the person in her family. There's something really cool about that exchange. And I think that far outweighs any burden of responsibility, for me anyway.
Well, that's amazing. Yeah.
You use that answer. Jesus, yeah.
Well, no, that's amazing. It's that's inspiring, a bit, yeah. That the storytelling is not just about the coffee and the quality of the product, is the storytelling behind. And is something inspiring, very inspiring. And like the part of the products, I want to ask about that. You guys said about like the coffee, but the pastries, everything is bought locally.
Yeah, well, I mean, the initial idea when we sat down, we kind of drew a circle.
Yeah.
And we said we wanted to get everything we sold within 5K
yeah.
of the building, which proved a slight challenge. But yeah. really, bar our ice cream, it's 10K.
Yeah.
So all of our pastries and, you know, vegan treats, everything is made in Greystones. Some people could literally walk their product from their household kitchens, because a lot of them are just small little artisan producers yeah. who have hazard-proof kitchens out their back, and they make little small products. They could almost walk it to us. That's how local they are, which is great in a sense, because we're then putting money back into our local community.
Yes.
We're highlighting this small producer. And I think certainly 2 to 3 of our local producers have had to increase their production days and employ more staff just to keep up with the production of what we've asked for. Because they used to make 50 units for certain coffee shops. Like, we're looking for 400 units in a week of certain products. So like, they've had to add days and add staff. Which again, it's just giving back. It's just, and then their staff come into us for coffee, because they're like, because they're like, well, this is a place I supply, and they come in and we have chats with them, and it just became a real kind of, I don't know what's the good word for them.
It's a circular economy.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
So our coffee, our pastries, everything.
I'd say the pastel de nata.
Yeah.
My God, I felt like I was like in Porto,
like in Lisbon.
Yeah, like eating the pastel de nata, and like I grew up, like half of my family is Portuguese and half is Italian, okay. Brazilian. Yeah?
Huh?
Yeah, yeah,
yeah. So when I grew up, like in Brazil, we have like the padarias. It's like a coffee shop / spa, everything in the one. And 90% of them is like the cheapest here is Italian, is Portuguese.
Yeah.
And I grew up like my aunt coming home, and she used to, back in the day, it used to be the bottles, the little bottles, the Coca-Cola with a crate of that, something you wouldn't have, and loads of treats and the pastel de nata. I swear to God, it brought me to my childhood when I had that. Amazing.
And I had a girl who, I know, and she's my next door neighbor, and she's from Lisbon.
Yeah.
And she came in and had it one day, and I went at the back and said, how's it? And I was a bit worried. I'm like, how? And she goes, she said exact same as where I grew up in Lisbon. She goes, because she said, I've tried to find them in Ireland. And she goes, I genuinely just struggle. And she said, to a point, she even called her husband, who's Irish, and she's like, do you want one? And she took the last one on the counter for him, just so he could taste it.
I suppose another aspect of you know, behind the, you know, the why of what we do is kind of a later addition. It wasn't in our initial vision, or we didn't set out to kind of achieve support in this area. You know, the war in Ukraine kicked off 6-8 months after we started the cafe. And Tiglin ended in a situation where we had a facility that had just become into our possession that was, an ideal use of was to offer it out to people who were being displaced by the war. And so we did that. And now we've over 100 people from Ukraine staying with us. And we provide a variety of different supports around that. But, you know, obviously people come to a country and they need to get involved in the community. They need to find work, whatever it might be. The cafe provided employment for some of the guys, some of the girls that work with Gavin behind the counter, but also to help, we produce a lot of the baked goods now ourselves. So we have,
so the pastel de natas, the cookies,
the, you know, those breakfast pots, all that kind of stuff. They're all produced mainly by the ladies who have come from Ukraine.
Who all had a background in baking. A lot of them were bakers back home.
Yeah, and they're perfectionists, which is great. Yeah. So it was again, it was a nice thing to be able to say, actually, do you know what? You may not want to work behind a counter. You may not be able to do that.
So, especially with their English, you know?
Yeah, English, childcare, whatever it might be. So we were able to create this commercial working environment where these ladies could work. They didn't have to worry so much about childcare. Most of their kids were in school. So they were able to kind of work around their own lives, support each other in it, get some employment. And then some of them obviously work with Gavin as well as colleagues behind the counter.
4 minutes walk from Carrigeaton.
So you have a bakery that support the community in that sense.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
And the bakery is just for the Rise or is for other places?
At the moment. For the Rise, yeah.
Wow.
But we have longer term plans to maybe develop something.
Well, I have to say like that's very good. You go back there now. Oh my God.
They get delivered at 10 o'clock every day. And they're gone by about 12.
Nice
really?
Warm at that time. So if you want them at 10, that's the best time to go.
Wow. Yeah, that's more or less the time I went there. They didn't have many. I looked.
Now, when we kind of get 6 to 8 midweek and then we get 20 maybe at the weekends.
Wow. I should have called the Portuguese guys. They're all in braid. They should go down there, you know? Like, it need to be 20 just for them. And, like, what's the challenge now you're facing, as you said, about the war and then the things changing, the coffee, the prices oscillating? It's kind of stabilizing now this year. And do you feel different now with the products, with all these situation around the world for the supply and keep the price steady without all
like we tried not to be, you know, to affect the prices from when we opened. If we ever did have to affect the prices because we incurred significant increases, like, you know, yourself in the industry, like a box of cups used to cost 40 euro, now it's 65 euro.
Yeah.
You know, like just the very basics, like the things that we don't, like the straws, the napkins, they've all doubled and tripled in price.
Mm-hmm.
But yes, I mean, it's not like petrol. You know, petrol can go from 150 to 190 overnight, you know, because they basically look at the raw produce. If it's costing more, they charge you more. You can't do that with a cup of coffee. I can't change the price of my cup of coffee every day. So we had to pick a price point that worked for us. And then we looked at every other coffee shop in Greystones and we kind of went middle to top range. But I had no problem with that because I knew we were going to be giving out one of the best cups of coffee in Greystones. So we could stand by that.
But also it was to ensure as well that we weren't, it's not to invite competition in terms of price. It's to basically say, look, we're going to present our best and we believe that if this is the going rate, we should charge the going rate. You know, because otherwise you're passing on that message to say the guy or the girl behind the counter matters that little bit less behind our counter than it does behind somebody else's counter.
Yeah.
So it was to make sure that actually, no, everybody holds their head.
Because we had done some research on some other social enterprise cafes and businesses, and that would seem to be the model where it was like 3.50 in a good coffee shop, but you go in there and you get it for 2 or 2.50.
Yeah.
But for me, that 2 or 2.50 doesn't represent a good deal.
Mm.
All it makes me think is it must be cheap and it must be bad quality.
Mm-hmm.
So there was no way we could enter the Greystones market, which has so many good coffee shops.
Oh, yes.
With an inferior price or product. So I was like, well, let's go at the very top end. Let's match everywhere and charge accordingly. But obviously then, the more money we can make as a social enterprise, all the profit we make goes back to support Tiglin. So like, not that we want to charge too much, but like if we're charging a good price and we make good profit, that all goes back to help people who are in the exact same situation as our employees. So, I mean, it just makes so much. And then people feel good because they come in and not only the treat for them is that they get a good cup of coffee, then they also feel great because they know all the money they gave to you goes back into a charity. Whereas if we had a poor product, they'd come in, they'd get a poor coffee, they'd go, oh, great, I'll support you for this one, but then I'm going to go around and get a proper coffee next day, you know? Yeah. So we had to keep them coming back.
Yeah, yeah.
And that was the challenge. But the guys just met it, you know, like I was like, this is the standard. And they all just got there so fast, like faster than I ever could have imagined. And like, I don't think any one of my staff, no, I don't think anyone had ever worked in a coffee, had ever worked in a coffee shop. Most of them didn't know what any of the products I was talking about were. Wow. Any of the words, even like a tamper, a knockbox, they were all looking at me as if I was speaking Portuguese. And I was like, straight away, I was like, this is a big challenge.
Yeah.
But they just got it so quick. And like I said to Phil, look, do me a favor. Don't let me open until these guys have at least got. So he said, take your time. So we took a full week and the coffee shop was pretty much ready to go. And I said, just give me a week to train these guys because I don't want to open the doors and I'm still trying to teach them what the basics are.
Yeah.
So we did a full week of training with all the coffee my brother had given me. And by the time we opened, they could all do, you know, the basic love hearts and they had their milks perfect. So at least the first few customers got that good coffee and they were like, well, actually, this is a good place, you know. And then they told their friends and the sea swimmers were the first to come in. Yeah. The first group of sea swimmers. And then as soon as they...
And what's hard, like with the sea swimmers now, you're saying, they go very early there.
Yeah.
What time are you opening?
We open at 7 every day.
7.
So we're one of the earliest. I mean,
For Greystone,
realistically in summer, yeah, but we could open at 5 in the summer when, you know, because sunrise is before 5,
yeah.
Middle of summer, and we would be full. Like, well, we're opening at 5 on Saturday for darkness into light.
Well.
And we are going to be out the door. I can guarantee for 5 o'clock. But like that's if you have a good if you're offering the right product and people will come if they're awake. Yeah. Like Phil's almost my first customer in the door.
He's kind of kid that wakes up at 4:30 in the morning.
So
like, I need my coffee.
I get in at 6:30 and I look around and Phil's standing there going, guys, like the machine's on.
To me, 7 o'clock almost feels like lunch.
Late,
like,
yeah.
Yeah, I know the feeling.
But it's lockdown did that.
Yeah.
Lockdown A made it go from 20 regular sea swimmers on that beach. Yeah. To 200. But it also made people realize, you know, there's a benefit in being up early, in doing exercise. Like, there's running clubs base their entire thing out of the coffee shop. They do a coffee run every Tuesday morning. It went from 10 people to 5. Now there's 30 do it every Tuesday morning. And I think that helped people realize, you know, when they just lost the whole thing of having to travel to town and work, they had a couple of months off and they were like, you know, let's enjoy life. Let's get up early.
And you guys have a lot of partnership with the guys doing their running, with the swimming, and they become part of your own community.
Yeah.
You're creating your own community now.
100%. And then two of my guys now join that running club and they run with them every Thursday. And one of the guys is training for the Eco Trail, which is a 47-kilometer run over Wicklow. And the guy who owns the running club is personally training him to run that.
Oh,
you know, so
in the men's rehab on a Saturday morning, they have, you might have heard of park run.
Yes.
So we have a closed park run group. It's only for the residents to attend, but it's a registered run. It has all the times and the tags and all that kind of stuff. So they get an opportunity to do that in a closed environment. And that's more just about doing a discipline. But it's also when it's your time to get a weekend home. You can start to see, is there a park run near me? So it's a healthy, normal, community-based activity that I can maybe bring my kids to. So it's been really interesting to watch some of the guys who maybe have no interest or no background at all in running, and yet they might go out on the weekend, join a local park run group in the area that their family are based. And it's a positive message to their children that even dad is up running in the morning, even if the kids don't go. So this is an example of one of the lads who, you know, how to develop this love for running, and that was doing something pretty extreme.
Like, now with all that spotlight on you and the business is thriving and the storytelling, all that is coming together, do you have that ambition to spread this business model to other places?
Look, I suppose Tiglin has always evolved in terms of what the next opportunity brings. I think there's always room to have strategic vision. I think that's important, but I don't think that can ever replace opportunities that come along sometimes at obscure times. So like, we could sit here now and say, yeah, we'd love to open another 5 coffee shops over the next 6 years or whatever. And you know what? Maybe that might happen. But you know, our product is not about the finance or the coffee as such. That's a byproduct. That's an important byproduct. You know, our focus is the ones who need the help, who have got stuck in life. So, you know, I think there's room to develop this type of a social enterprise, and maybe that might be us that does that. But equally speaking, I sat with another charity recently because they wanted to set up a cafe in, you know, somewhere in Dublin, and we had a chat about things that we did at the start, what worked, what didn't work, that kind of stuff. So it's about sharing that knowledge, maybe that it might work for others. I could safely say we probably will end up opening up another cafe somewhere at some point in the near future. But I think there's other opportunities, and we've talked a little bit about the baking and the developing of our own products, things like that. I think there's room in that. There's room in the kind of merchandise franchise, merchandise type of base I think there's potential as well. We've been working with Gavin's brother around grinding the coffee and putting our own label on it, that kind of stuff. I think that industry can grow and it can create valuable training opportunities. It doesn't mean you have to have, expensive premises to run. So I think you can grow what we're already doing before we get into replicating another cafe. That's my hunch. But again, I'm an opportunist. I don't really plan a whole.
Honestly, Phil could get a phone call tomorrow, and that this is the, he'd be like, "This is what we're doing next." And I've kind of learned to just go, "Yeah," just say yeah, because that's initially. I think you probably agree. I was not that I was a naysayer, but if Phil would say something, I'd be like, "Well, these are the downfalls, and these are the pitfalls, and we can't do it because of this." But then every time Phil brought an idea, and eventually he, it would end up we'd end up trying it anyway. Now I just kind of go, yeah, well, let's try. And not every idea we have, works out. But I think I'd say the vast majority of stuff we've tried just has worked. And it's kind of this little perfect storm that's been created down there. Like it just, no matter what we seem to try, it seems to stick. And obviously,
That's perfect.
but that won't last forever. And we know that. And, for the first time probably in my life, I'm really enjoying being in work. Like I look forward to going to work in the morning, which is, yourself, it's a lovely feeling because I've been in this industry since I'm 15. I've had awful jobs in the industry, in bar work and, where you're literally kind of going, I can't believe I have to go in here again. Whereas I wake up and I'm like, can't wait to see Sean, can't wait to see Ali, can't wait to see the guys, can't wait to see the customers, because the customers are like our best mates. Like we know we could have 20 people in a queue and we would know 15 of the orders, before they came in, and we have their cups behind the counter, so we'd already have their coffee on before they get up and stuff, and that kind of
That's amazing.
But as a customer, I would love that. If someone had my coffee ready and kind of already had it put down and had my pastry that I normally have or cut in half, but it took a lot of work, to get my staff that we all know. So everyone that works there knows the order and knows the name and knows the auntie and the uncle of that person and what they might order. Like it takes a lot of.
Is the anticipation normally as a guest going to a restaurant or a cafe and somebody recognize you?
Yeah, it's amazing, isn't
Is
it? There's nothing better.
as
You feel so.
Mastercard, you would say, like the money can buy. What was the slogan they had? The for everything else, use Mastercard. I remember that one. It's basically that. Is you go there, you feel loved in a sense. That's amazing. And what I should be expecting now for the future for the rise. That's a big question, after
I suppose it's not that it's dated, but like, I mean, we already planned this summer before Christmas. Like we were already talking about what we're going to do this summer. Last November, we were like, what do we need to put in place? Like, what do we need to have ready? But I mean, things can change in an instant. Like two of my guys could leave in the morning, but I mean, that's the same in any,
Everywhere.
in
Everywhere.
everywhere.
Yes.
So, I mean, you kind of got to work on the fly, this summer, I suppose we just want to replicate last summer. Last summer was incredible. Probably just, I mean, there's only so much we can do as well. Like with a three group coffee machine, you can only make so many coffees. So, I mean, unless we add a second machine somewhere, which wouldn't be probably feasible, you can only make so many coffees. So, like, there is a limit to what we can do in such a tiny space, but we push that limit most days. Like, I think yesterday was one of our busiest days ever, and it's a bank holiday in May, and it was amazing. No one waited more than 5 minutes for a coffee, and we had a queue at the door all day. But like, it was a great buzz, for the staff, for the customers. But that will be almost every day this summer, if things go well.
Yeah, I think the kind of the measure of success though is like, because it's not a finance-based model, it's not about how much money you can bring in or turnover. That's a kind of a byproduct, and it's a very nice byproduct to be able to have that, fallback. It's about the level of engagement, it's about the quality, about the acceptance of the community, about the employment of people. It's about reducing the margins within society that people find themselves in, those kinds of things. So like last summer, we opened up a little ice cream shed. And again, the original idea was that our friends from Ukraine had just literally landed in this strange town, and
He was on Paddy's Day, wasn't he?
And so we had quite a number of them who found themselves coming into the summertime, who are 15, 16, 17 years of age, who didn't really know people in the town, wanted to work. It's in their psyche, it's in their blood to work,
So I
wanted
suppose as we
jobs.
all did, we got summer jobs,
And so we opened this little ice cream shed, and the idea was, I don't even care whether it sold ice creams or not. I want somebody to have a job, you know, and it did what it needed to do. So we'll probably just look to develop that a little bit this year. I think, you know, if we were to kind of cast our minds back to the few minutes ago, looking at the product, you know, the different products that we have produced and continue to produce, I think behind that, the name itself, Rise at the Cove, has become a little bit of its own brand as such. And it's to maybe look at the opportunities that brings in and to see, can we cultivate behind the scenes, is there ways that we can use either that brand to create more products or to go in other directions and
create more employment as well.
Yeah. That brings, you know, it doesn't have to be all about food or cooking of food or serving food. We need people in the background that can help run that opportunity, that social enterprise.
Well,
so, yeah.
Well done, guys. Mm. Thank you very much, Phil, Gavin. Lovely to have you in. And thank you very much for today's sponsor.
Today's sponsor is Foodcast. Do you want to promote your brand or product in an effective way, direct to our public? Check our website, social media, and all products and services we provide. Contact us for more information. This is Foodcast, where you promote your brand and more.
How people can reach out to you and talk to you if they want an opportunity, like even for the Rise of the Cove, or for even for a Tiglin. Yeah, sorry, the foreigner here trying to speak.
Yeah, so Tiglin, we have our own, there's a website there, and there's a need help button on the website. So if you're looking for help, even if you're the loved one of somebody looking for the help, you can click the button, put in an inquiry, and we can start a conversation. If we can't help, we'll point you towards somebody that can, and be that around addiction, homelessness, even the family support element, whatever that might be, if we can help, we will try to do that.
That's amazing.
And then for the cafe, the best is to either drop in and talk, you know, and that's always, we find that's the best way to actually talk to someone behind the counter. But then direct message via Instagram, and we're currently working on developing a website as well.
Well, that's great. Thank you very much. And don't forget to smash that like, follow, and share button. This is Foodcast, where you listen or watch your podcast and more.
Awesome. Thanks a minute.
Thank you very much.
Appreciate it.
That was great, guys.